So in the last class, here's what we discussed. We started with the age-old question of Torah and science as a perceived conflict, and we used two of the classic examples. But the resolution we came to is following the principle of the approach of the Rambam, that Torah and science are not really they're not in conflict, but rather they're two different approaches to religious experience, or what the Rambam calls Ahavat Hashem. Ooh, this is terrible. I don't know why it's coming out this way, but okay, we'll deal with it. So the first Torah is the expression of God's will. It's God's way of communicating to us his laws and values, etc. And science is what we would call God's handiwork, what he created, the rules of nature, etc. But perceiving both of those, says Maimonides, are essential. We don't really have a good way of knowing God. So the two ways that we have are what he's expressed as God's will, what the way he wants to see the world or human beings operate. And number two, that which created by reflecting on created the sophistication, the rules, etc., is a way of coming to an appreciation of God. And what we did was we took that approach to the two classic questions or the two classic examples of science and Torah being in conflict. The first being, how old is the world, right? So on the one hand, we learn the kids in day school, if they have Torah studies in the morning, they learn that the world is 5,780 years old. And if they have, and then when they go to general studies in the afternoon and they have biology, they hear that the world is 15 billion years old, right? So which is it? So what we, using this approach, the way we understood this is that from a perspective of Torah, so Torah is again God's will and reflects the relationship between God and human beings. So Rosh Hashanah, which is when our year flips every year, Rosh Hashanah celebrates the beginning of God's relationship with humanity. And that relationship, we have no earlier record of God having a relationship with humankind before the 5,780 years that are recorded in the Torah. And so on Rosh Hashanah, we celebrate that relationship, and we also talk about the ramifications of that relationship, namely our accountability, being judged, etc. That's 5,780 years ago. From the perspective of science, so by looking at God's handiwork and applying the scientific principles that we know, so evidence of God's handiwork dates back 15 billion years ago. Science is not interested in the spiritual relationship between mankind and God. Science is interested in measuring and observing God's handiwork. And from that perspective, from the perspective of science, we have evidence 15 billion years ago. And that's how we resolve this issue. The answer is these dates and these number of years in conflict, they're just measuring completely different things. One is the relationship, God's relationship with humanity. The other is the natural world that's a product of God's handiwork. And then the other question, how did the world,
Ravari, I was just going to say it's 95% fine, but every once in a while there's a little cracking. So if it's not too difficult, and you can quickly switch, and that would be better. Also, if you have a headset, that sometimes works better. I apologize to everybody for this, but thank God this is a very actually rare occurrence. But please, God, it'll be, we want to make it as close to 100% as we can.
Okay, so just give me one
Yeah,
second.
I understand. That's fine.
The other thing I find that seems to work with this stuff is dialing in versus using your computer speakers.
I wouldn't even know how to do that, but okay. I mean, what do you do? You go to Zoom, and then what do?
There's you can say call by phone, and it gives you a list of numbers for Canada or the country that you're in. And you dial in, and you give it the code for the Zoom number and your participant code.
Very interesting. You know what? I don't even see that on my screen. It could be because I'm the host, the way it's set up. I automatically go in. I really don't even know. But okay, I'll have to ask my kids how to do that.
Yeah, it works. I know, because I use WebEx during the day for work, and it makes a big difference.
I mean, thank God we've had, you know, probably already 35 classes. I only... One other class was there a small problem. Thank God every class has been pretty much like 100% clear. But okay, it's good to know. These things do happen once in a while. Technology is never perfect. And
well, you have no quality of service on the internet. Just remember that.
I'm sorry?
We don't have quality of service, QoS, on the internet network. Therefore, that's why a lot of voice over IP runs on private links, doesn't run over the internet, because it's too flaky.
Okay, let's see if this is better. Does any change right off the bat?
So far,
there are some people who are asking for the password. It's not letting them on without the password.
They shouldn't need a password. All they have to do is click the link that was in the, I don't even remember what the password is. It's embedded in the link.
Right, but... Some people
you have to register. I mean, you can't get it unless you register. This is sort of the Zoom security. But when you get the link, I mean, you just click the link. The password is embedded. I'd have to go figure out even what it is, to be honest.
You had to register beforehand?
You can register right now, and you'll get it. Once you register, you get an automatic email like telling you
what to tell them that. Okay,
yeah.
Thanks.
Okay. I'm sorry. Okay, Ravari, let's get back. No more interruptions, please, God, till... question and answer at the end of the lecture. Okay.
Okay. So I just have to figure out now how to minimize, because now the Zoom is taking up part of my screen, but okay.
We can hear you fine.
Yeah, I just have to move the Zoom thing out of the way of my presentation. Okay, I'm good. All right. So the second question we dealt with, how did the world come to being? Because that is also perceived as a potential conflict between Torah and science, right? The Torah saying that the world was created in 6 days, and science telling us that the world and species evolved over a period of millions of years. There existed, we saw our friend Lucy from the Museum of Natural History, that there were forms of mankind, early forms of human and hominoids. And okay, so without getting into the full discussion, how do we resolve that? Very simple. The Torah is not teaching us biological science. That's not the purpose of Torah. The Torah wants to teach us the fundamentals of our relationship with God. So it wants to teach us what is this God, and what role do we play in his universe? And so from that perspective, what the Torah is teaching us, and we looked at this, we did some text study, the Torah teaches us there's a planful creator who brings order, and that's the Shoresh Boker, which means to clarify or to investigate, brings order from chaos over 6 highly structured and patterned periods, right? And the word yom in Tanakh oftentimes means a period. Bayom hahu yiyeh Hashem echad u'shmo echad. And we looked at what the first chapter of Reishit is trying to communicate to us. We saw the internal structure of each day that shows how God had an agenda, and then he put it into practice, and he summarized, he evaluated. We saw the really amazing relationships between the different days of creation, and what's presented to us is God bringing a world of chaos into order in a planful, organized, and deeply connected way through patterns and structure. That's what the Torah is teaching us. What is science? Science teaches us, how did this actually come to being? How did our natural world move from chaos to order. And there, scientists tell us that it happened through the evolution of species from the simple to complex. And then one of the last things we noted is that all the Torah teaches us is that in this sixth period of creation, God started with terrestrial animals, with land animals. And the last thing that was created was mankind, who essentially became mankind when God breathed this breath of divine life into mankind. And so we saw, and by the way, if you joined us for the last class, I put out a source sheet that has some of the sources that we weren't really able to delve into that I just mentioned casually, but they're really worth looking at. The Tiferet Yisrael, major commentary on the Mishnah, who talks about the human forms that existed before Adam, but in the evolutionary process, they simply were not sophisticated enough to have a relationship with God. And so God waited until that evolutionary course had developed far enough that this being had enough intelligence to have a relationship with God, and at that point endowed that human being with the divine image, thus beginning the relationship of God and mankind 6,000 years ago. So the important point is that when you understand science to be an additional component of our religious experience of God, then you begin to understand that the Torah is not a book of science. Science is not interested in the same things that Torah is, but taken together, they provide a much richer understanding of the world in which we live, of God's handiwork, and the relationship that we have to have with God. That's our summary of part one. Okay, so why then are Torah and science thought to be in conflict? Because after all, right, much of our Jewish world, certainly in the Orthodox community, and in the broader world of faith, this is thought of as a significant conflict. So let's just do a little quick review, kind of historically, of why Torah and science. Why do we struggle so much with science? So it begins, of course, with the scientific revolution in the 16th and 17th centuries, right? So in the course of just over a century, you have some of the greatest scientific discoveries that lay the foundation for modern science and dramatically alter the way in which we perceive and understand our universe. Okay, so Copernicus, Kepler, Galileo, the heliocentric theory of cosmology, right, with planets revolving around the sun. William Gilbert and the theory of magnetism, which is the precursor to electricity. Van Leeuwenhoek, the microscope and opening up the world of microbiology and cellular biology. Basilius and Harvey developed the theory and anatomy of circulation, something that we'll come back to a little bit later in this lecture. Meaning that until the 17th century, we didn't understand the basics of how blood is circulated, or even that blood is circulated through the human body, something we take for granted now. Sir Francis Bacon and Descartes contribute empiricism, and ultimately those tools are developed into the scientific method by which our universe is explored empirically, tested, theorized, proven, et cetera, the basics of modern science. And Huygens and Newton developed the theories of mechanics, right, force and motion, and wave theory, which is optics. And so one can only imagine the revolution that took place during this time. Now, why is that significant for this conversation? because there's a reason why this is called a scientific revolution. And that's because many of these philosophers really saw these not just as discoveries that were augmenting the way the world was understood, but rather as a complete revolution, out with the old and in with the new. To that point, the way in which humanity in general understood the universe around them and explained why things happened and what made them happen, and even tried to predict what would happen, was all in the realm of religion. With the scientific revolution, there were many who thought this was the beginning of the end of religion, that had been the way of understanding one's world up until then, but now science provided an entirely new way of understanding our world without what had come to be seen by this time as the abusive role of religion, particularly of the church, although there were certainly similar feelings about rabbinic control of Jewish life, and it's not an accident that there are a number of rebellions starting with and then, of course, reform that emerged right around this time in the century that follows, right? So this is a time out with the old, in with the new. And essentially, that occurs across three different major areas of life. One is religion, which we just mentioned. The whole way in which the world was ordered, imperialism, there were revolutions against that, revolutions against the established social order. And so there was a sense that these new ideas of science posed a major threat, certainly to established religion. Just for our sake, we're going to focus on established and traditional religion. The world observed the kind of attack on the Catholic Church, or the perceived threat to the Catholic Church. And at the same time, there was also a perceived threat to traditional Judaism. And it's not an accident that in the century that follows, with Enlightenment and such, that there is now major threats to traditional Judaism. And so how does Judaism respond to these threats? We're condensing so much history into just a couple of sentences, but essentially traditional Judaism takes one of two paths. One is a path of insularity and isolationism, which basically says, in order to continue traditional Judaism, we have to isolate ourselves from all these new ideas, scientific revolution, enlightenment, etc. That's the concept, the slogan that categorizes this approach is the notion of chadash asur min ha-Torah, that anything is new must be forbidden according to the Torah. But it really reflects an attitude that in order to survive, we simply have to cut ourselves off, hold on to the old, resist the new. According to that approach, science was viewed as a threat. And because the adherents of that approach, which we might loosely call ultra-Orthodox Judaism today, because that world seeks to essentially maintain many of the attitudes that characterized the isolationist Judaism of the 19th century, it's in many ways actually a stated goal, and it's reflected in dress, in language, in maintaining certain stances that oppose modern ideas. So the attitude of science as threat has also been maintained as part of what would be considered traditional Judaism. But the second approach within Orthodoxy was that, yes, modernity posed certain challenges and had to be grappled with, but not everything that was new was problematic. And there were certainly aspects of this newness that ought to be, not just that could be, but that ought to be proactively integrated and synthesized into Judaism. And science fell into that category. Science was not necessarily seen as a threat, but rather science was seen as the generations prior who had dabbled, if you will, in pre-modern science, like Rambam, like some of the Renaissance Jewish Italian thinkers who were very focused on science and medicine. So this approach of neo-Orthodoxy or modern Orthodoxy would continue to see science as a religious component, not necessarily as a threat, as one of those things to integrate. Okay, and so we land up with two different approaches to science. One instinctively says that science is a threat to Torah or to traditional Judaism, and the other, which maintains this Maimonidean idea, that science is not a threat, and science actually has a very positive place alongside Torah as a component of religious life. Okay, so our relationship with science impacts two major areas, and these are two areas that we're going to focus on in the rest of this class. So one is what I would call modern medical halakha. There's a number of different topics we could choose. I chose two because I think they're easy to illustrate in a fairly concise way, right? How the relationship with science impacts on those areas. And the second is what we might call public health issues. And we'll talk about two of those, although it'll become fairly obvious how our relationship with science very quickly dictates our position and our attitude towards some of these public health issues. Okay, so before we get into the study of the modern medical issues and new text, one thing that's very important to understand, I'm going to give a quick intro to the theory of psak halacha. Okay? All right. So we even get a little parshat haShavua, so you get a Dvar Torah for your Shabbos table for this week, because this comes from the second of this week's parshiot, Parshat Mesora. So the Torah says, "V'ra'aha kohenes hanega be'or habasar v'se'ar banega hafach lavan u'mar'ei hanega amok me'or b'saro nega tzara'as hu." Okay, so you summon the Kohen. The Kohen is acting as a halachic authority here. This is a person who sees some sort of blemish on their skin, and because it might be the dreaded tzara'at, this dreaded disease, you call the expert, which is the Kohen, and the Kohen takes a look at the blemish on the skin, right? And then he looks at the different parameters, because there's rules about this blemish and what makes it tzara'at. So he has to look at the blemish itself, he has to look at the hair within, and the coloring around and in the center. He has to look at the visual evidence, and he knows the parameters and the rules, right? So the I should say he comes, he looks, he examines, and he renders his decision. That's not what the pasuk says. Second half of the pasuk says, "V'ra'ahu hakohen v'timei oso." And I guess from a pshat standpoint, meaning from just the simple, straightforward reading of the verse, you would say that "v'ra'ahu hakohen v'timei oso" means the Kohen looks at the blemish, and then if it fits all the parameters, renders this individual ritually impure, right? My great teacher of Aaron Lichtenstein, I heard this from him a number of times, and I think you would hardly find a student who didn't at some point or another hear this from him, because he felt so strongly about this. He said that wasn't his understanding of the pasuk. His understanding of the pasuk was the first half of that this pasuk actually lays out the the parameters and the equation for psak halacha. And the first part is the kohen has to examine the evidence by the legal specifications, right? Is it the right color? Is it the right shape? This, that, right? But that's only part of it. The next part is the kohen has to look at the individual and the individual's circumstances. And only after taking those into consideration can the kohen render his decision. So it's only after he looks at the nega and the se'ar and the mar'e, etc., then vir'au ha-kohen, he has to look at the person, and only then does he render a decision, which essentially means that psak halacha consists of two parts. The first is what we might call halacha, which is Talmudic legal principles, right? And they're debated, and they're ultimately clarified, and they're codified, and they are legal principles. Okay, but the second part is there is also a reality. There's a specific set of circumstances that pertain to this individual who is asking the question or who finds themselves in a certain situation that requires a halachic decision. And that means that the formula for psak is essentially a mathematic formula. And that is, you have a set of Talmudic principles, which are then, you might say, multiply. And I use multiply, not addition, because there's a certain factoring relationship here. One is multiplied by what we call reality, this specific set of circumstances. Those circumstances can be scientific, technological, emotional, right? They can be internal to the person, they can be external to the person, but they reflect the reality of the here and now with this individual in the context that that person lives. When you take those two factors and you combine them, that's when you get psak halacha. That's how you come to a halachic ruling, okay? And so what that means is, like a mathematic equation, right? So changes in reality will yield change in psak. So if 1,000 years ago there was a psak halacha, right? You know, we can read about in the halachic literature, this is how this particular question is to be decided. And we have a psak halacha in 2020, and the 2020 psak halacha is different than the one from 1,000 years ago. So there are some who would say, well, that can't be, because then you're changing halacha. And
halacha doesn't change. It's a set of principles. And the answer is,
you're right. It's not halacha necessarily that's changing. These legal principles are time-honored and eternal. Because psak is a function of reality as well, when the circumstances in that reality change. So when science, when scientific knowledge changes, when sociological factors change, psak will change. If you try to keep psak constant when reality changes, right? Somebody, you know, especially if you're a mathematician, what have you done in that case? If reality changes and psak stays the same, then what have you done? Anyone? That's when you've changed halacha, right? Because that's the way the mathematic formula would have to be. If the reality changes and the psak stays the same, okay, you'd have to change halacha by a certain factor in order to arrive at the same psak, right? Which is a really interesting way of looking at that. It also, by the way, explains why the great poskim oftentimes gave different piskei halacha to different people. And especially with Rav Soloveitchik, it's oftentimes, you know, you get all kinds of machloket that Rav Soloveitchik said this, Rav Soloveitchik said that, and Rav Soloveitchik said a third and a fourth thing. And people throw up their hands in exasperation, but of course, because being the great halachist that he was, he understood that each psak halacha had a certain reality to it around the person, the circumstance. And so, yes, there will be different piskei halacha for different people. Okay, so this is a very important principle to understand as we look at some of the modern medical halacha and their relationship to Talmudic texts. Okay, so there's some things that have disappeared from my PowerPoint. So this slide should be titled Mitzitza Bepeh. And we're going to do a quick examination. This, we could spend easily 2 hours talking about this topic, but my goal is not to go through all the sources and do a complete analysis of each of these issues. It's really just to kind of show you the challenge of deciding medical halakha on the basis of Talmudic texts and maybe kind of give you an approach that will be helpful in tackling different issues. Okay, so mitzitza bepeh. So you've probably have heard of the kind of controversies over the last couple of years of this particular aspect of Brit Milah that involves oral suction of blood from the wound site immediately after circumcision. And the reason why it's made headlines a few times in the last decade is because, unfortunately, a number of newborns have been infected with a herpes virus. As a result, be infected by the mohel who transmitted the virus via this procedure. Okay, and so there erupted a controversy that here modern science is telling us this is a terrible thing to do, because it goes against every principle of hygienic surgery and disease transmission, right? But it would seem that Torah and Halacha have this time-honored ritual, which we're generally not very prepared to give our time-honored rituals, right? Okay, so let's see. How do we evaluate, how do we assess this particular topic? So it starts with a Mishnah in Masechet Shabbat, which says, Osin kol tzarchei milah b'shabbat, mo'alimu porin motitzin, v'notnin aleha isplanis uchemur. So the Mishnah outlines the different components of the Brit Milah and says that all of them can be done on Shabbat, right? So mo'alin is the actual cutting of the foreskin. Pour in is separating it. There's a process of separating the layers. Motzitzin, that's the evacuating blood from the wound site. And then it's post-op bandaging with salve. Okay, so that's a bandage and some sort of salve that they used on the bandage, okay? And the Mishnah says all these things can be done even on Shabbat. So the Gemara wants to understand how all these things can be done on Shabbat. So Amar of Papa, Hai Umana Delo Mietz Sakanahu V'Arinan Lei. So the Gemara says that any mohel that doesn't do mitzitza, right, that doesn't use oral suction, well, shouldn't say that, who doesn't use suction to evacuate the blood from the wound, is causing the child danger, is endangering the child, and should therefore be removed from his position as mohel. His credentials should be revoked. Okay, says the Gemara, Pshita, well, of course, midekal mechalalei alea shabasa sakanahu. So the Gemara says, of course, the only justification, because the Brit Milah process is already done, the only justification for doing this which is normally not permitted on Shabbat. You're normally not allowed to either cause a wound or evacuate blood from a wound. Not allowed to do that on Shabbat. So the only justification for doing it on Shabbat is that it is to not do it would endanger the child. And of course, anything that would that causes danger or anything that removes danger can and must be done on Shabbat. So essentially, the Gemara is asking, I know that Mila and Priya are fundamental parts of the ritual. I know that bandaging and salve are important parts, but that's post-op care so that the child is not endangered. Where does mitzitza fit? And the Gemara clearly establishes that mitzitza is a medical procedure which is justified on Shabbat, not because it's part of the Brit Milah ritual, but because, like bandaging and applying salve, if you didn't do so, you would severely endanger the infant. Okay, so what does that tell us? It tells us that the whole reason for this step of mitzitza, of evacuating the blood, was because they thought that not doing so endangered the child. Okay, that's very clear from the Gemara. So it's true that we are a people that like to keep our rituals constant. So if this was the way that Brit Milah was always done, then unless there's some reason to not do that, then that was the way it continued to be done for quite a while, okay? So the first thing we need to do in assessing whether or not this is appropriate to do now, and there's not just a question of endangering the child. There's actually a question of whether or not, if you have a Brit Milah on Shabbat, whether you should do this step of mitzitza at all, because the only justification, according to the Talmud, is because to not do so would place the baby in danger. Well, but we know, based on our own scientific knowledge, that that's not the case. And if that's not the case, then it's quite possible that there's no justification for doing mitzitza on Shabbat, right? But the first thing we have to understand is what were the circumstances? What did they see or think that required them to do mitzitza? Okay, so just to give you an indication, look at the bottom of the page here. So this is from an article a few years ago in the Chakira Journal, right? Which actually explains Greek medicine maintained that stagnating blood will decay. In decaying, it might become pus. Parts around the wound will develop spasm, attract blood, become soaked with it, and decay. Essentially, what did they see? They saw that when someone has an open wound, that afterwards they witnessed infection, right? They witnessed the swelling. They saw that it became puffy and red. Of course they did, right? Because we know that that's what happened. And they needed to try to understand why is that happening and what can we do to try to avoid it. And they thought, based on their understanding of medicine, that the source of this infection was coming from within, that it was the presence of blood that remained in the wound that caused this decay. Okay, that was their theory of medicine. And they had no idea that the source of the infection was bacteria and microorganisms that were coming from the outside and getting into the wound. They just didn't know that. They didn't understand that. They had no sense of microorganisms. So, and this thought is, as he writes, hinted at many times in the Hippocratic corpus, when all wounds draw their inflammation and swelling from the surrounding parts of the body because of the blood flowing into them. Therefore, in every recent wound, it is expedient to cause blood to flow from it abundantly, for thus will the wound and adjacent parts be less attacked with inflammation. Okay, so in order to really properly process this halachically, we have to understand, right? We understand the halacha. The halacha is that the ritual of Brit Milah overrides Shabbat. That's a special rule in halacha. We also understand that anything which is dangerous and puts the child at risk overrides Shabbat. Those are the legal principles here, okay? So when the Gemara says that, or when the Mishnah says that you have to do mitzitza, and the Gemara says that anyone who doesn't do mitzitza has should have their credentials as a moho removed, first thing we need to do is understand what reality, what knowledge were they working with scientifically, or with respect to medicine. And now that we understand that, right? So now we understand why they felt it was so important to evacuate the blood from the wound on Shabbat, okay? Then the question is going to be, well, what happens when we now know that not only is that not effective, but actually puts the child further at risk? Okay, so we'll hold that for a minute as we look at, oh, there's my mitzitza bepeh. Okay, so let's look at the next slide, which should also have a title that disappeared. And this one is defining, yeah, whoops. Sorry. Sorry. All right. Okay, defining death. So here, the Mishnah, which is the basic Talmudic text and principle, explains that if a structure collapsed on Shabbat and you're not sure whether somebody is trapped underneath, so you have to start removing the rubble, searching for potential survivor. Says the Mishnah, if the person is alive, keep going, because we have to save life on Shabbat. We suspend the rules of Shabbat in order to save life. But if it becomes clear that it's not a rescue mission, but rather a recovery mission, because the victim unfortunately has died, then as important as Kavod HaMeid is and expedient burial is, those considerations don't override Shabbat, and we would have to leave the disaster site, the collapsed building, until after Shabbat, when we could then recover the body. Okay, so the Gemara now has to ask a very critical question. If the person's alive, I have to violate Shabbat and continue to dig. If the person is dead, I can't. So the Gemara says, so you have to tell me, how do I know if a person is alive or dead? So says the Talmud, ad heichan hu bodek. So how far do you have to dig in the rubble in order to determine whether or not the person is alive? Says the Gemara, ad chotmo, until the nose. Then there's a second opinion, which according to almost every single source is until the navel. There's one version, it seems like Rashi had a different version of the text, but only Rashi, which said, check up until you get to the heart, okay? Now it sounds like it could be a very significant difference, but it doesn't really matter, because the conclusion of the Talmud unequivocally is that you have to check until the victim's nose, right? So essentially, the Talmud is establishing that the definition of death is absence of respiration, right? And they bring a verse to support this. So the bottom line is, if you uncover the nose and there's no breathing, then the person is dead and you have to leave the person. If you can uncover any other part of the body, but until you get to the nose, you haven't yet determined whether or not the victim has died. So it's very clear that respiration is the key factor. So in explaining all this, I look at the bottom of the page, the Rambam, Maimonides, in his explanation of the Mishnah and then subsequently the Gemara that follows, says as follows, mifakhin, what does that mean? It means chofrin u'mechapsin acharav. You dig and you search for the victim. Im higia l'chotmo v'lo matzalo nishima. If you get to the nose and there is no breathing, asur lo lachpor yoter. You cannot continue to dig. Why? Sheharei hu meis bevadai. Because if you don't find respiration in the nose, then the person has certainly died. Okay, certainly died. Now, why does the Rambam have to add the phrase, the person has certainly died? Anyone want to answer that question? It would be great to get some interaction. Anyone? Why does he have to say certainly?
Because if there's any chance that he's still alive, you want to keep on digging.
Right. Not only do you want to, but you have to.
You should, yeah.
Because the halacha is safek pikuach nefesh is docheh shabbat, right? If there's even a chance that this would be a life-saving activity, that you have to violate Shabbat to do it. So in the Rambam has to say that if the Talmud says that you get to the nose and there's no breathing, that you stop, it must be because it is with certainty that the person has died. Okay? That's what the Talmud establishes. Okay? So let's take a look. So this Gemara essentially gives us two different conclusions. One, it concludes unequivocally that death is defined by the absence of respiration. And that is then affirmed by the Rambam, by the Shulchan Aruch, by every halachic codification there is. There is no dissenting opinion with respect to this Gemara that death is defined by the absence of respiration, right? So it doesn't even matter that interesting difference of manuscript, whether the other opinion is heart or navel. It's interesting and informative, but it has no basis on, has no impact on the halakha, okay? But the other thing that this Gemara concludes is that lack of respiration in the nose is indicative of certain death. And that's why if you don't find respiration, you must stop digging. That's what the Talmud says. That's what is codified in the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch says exactly what the Talmud says. If there is no breathing in the nose, then you may not continue to dig, okay? So now we have an important question, if we just stop right here, okay? So there's probably a Hatzalah member in the audience, because that's just a good bet anytime you bring a group of Jews together, right? So if I asked you, if a Hatzalah member got called to the scene of a car accident on Shabbat and found the victim to not exhibit any visual signs of breathing, there is no respiration through the nose of the victim, right? So maybe you can't yet get the victim out of the car, but you can access enough to see there is no breathing coming from the victim's nose. So I ask you, would that Hatzalah member leave the scene and say, I can't get the jaws of life out. I can't cut through the wreckage of the car because this patient, by halachic standards, considered dead, and I cannot do that. I cannot recover the body on Shabbat. Is there? Does anyone think there's any Hatzalah member anywhere in the world who would take that approach?
It would depend upon what you're using the jaws of life for. If it's a question of the person is certainly dead, then there's no point in extracting the body by a Hatzalah member on Shabbos. On the other hand, if he's going to take the person out.
Let me interrupt you for a second. Because I want to be careful here. I didn't use the terms definitely dead. I'm just giving you a scenario. The scenario is that the Hatzalah member arrives on the scene, is able and sees there is no respiration. This patient is not breathing through the nose. That's all they determine. That's it. I'm just asking you, on the basis of that, would that person walk away?
I would hope not.
Yeah, I would hope. I would hope not.
No, seriously, the person could, the Hatzalah member could do cardiorespiratory.
CPR.
We now know that there's more than the nose. You can give a bump to the chest. The guy can have something impeding his trachea. There's various things that could be done because it's not necessarily death.
So you're of course exactly right. And there is no Hatzalah member who would walk away from this victim and this accident just because they don't find breathing coming from the nose. Okay. And that's in Borough Park, Williamsburg, Toronto, New York, Muncie, Baltimore, doesn't matter. Okay. And Hatzalah is a very frum organization. It's also an amazingly wonderful life-saving organization. But just you have to just stop and realize for a second that the Shulchan Aruch says if there is no breathing in the nose, then you cannot continue to violate Shabbat to rescue this person. And yet every Hatzalah member, with the backing of every halachic authority, would say, even if the person's not breathing through the nose, in this case, you have to continue to save them. Okay. And we'll get to why in a second. Okay. But it's really important to realize that the formulation of the Talmudic text, right, does not yield the same psak today as it did in Talmudic times. Okay. All right. So now let's move on because we don't have too much time left. So let me just tell you very quickly. So in Talmudic times, death was defined by lack of respiration. Okay. Moving on from Talmudic times, essentially in the general history of medicine, death was then defined for the next few centuries death was determined, by one of two approaches, okay? One, you might call the traditionalist approach, and that is, I put a feather underneath the person's nose, and if the feather is ruffled, then the person is breathing, and if the feather is not, then the person is dead. And you find this is not, I'm not talking about halacha, I'm not talking about Judaism, I'm just talking about how medicine was practiced. You find this in plenty of general history of medicine sources. And in fact, the Chaye Adam in his Chachmas Adam, so that's Rav Danziger, who was a great student of the Noda B'Yehuda, who lived in the latter part of the 18th century, in the early 19th century. The early 19th century was one of the great halachic decisors. He writes in his instructions to Chevra Kadisha, if you in order to determine when the person has expired, you place a feather under the nose and you see if they're breathing or not, right? So still in the 19th century, that's the way death was being determined. But not entirely, because they're also developed in the centuries after that, what we might call a masora of cardiac death, right? So as the centuries went on,
science and medicine got a little bit more sophisticated and realized that, as some of you said, there could be reasons why there's no breath, there's no air coming out of the nose. It could be, right, an airway obstruction, and therefore maybe a better way, right, which they observed based on their process of observation, a better way to determine death would be to measure for a pulse and see if there was a pulse, right? And why is that? For two reasons. Number one, they very correctly associated the beating of the heart with breathing, right? If they did not find a pulse, they could be certain, right? Because those things happen within sometimes seconds, maybe minutes of one another, but certainly a very short period of time. If there wasn't a pulse, there would not be breathing, right? Before modern resuscitative medicine, if there was no pulse, there was no breathing. And so in some circles of medicine, the standard by which you could determine death became measuring for a pulse, right? And again, that's true in Jewish circles as well. So you will find in the responsa literature as time goes on, you will find reference to a heartbeat, okay? So when you come to the 20th century, and then of course in the 21st century, you have a new question, and that is the question of brain death, okay? Because for the first time, you can actually isolate the process of breathing, which is controlled by the brain, and the process of circulation, which is controlled by the heart. So now I have a question. A patient who's determined to be brain dead, which is not a coma, we don't have time to go into all that, but that means that the respiratory center of the brain in the brainstem is completely unresponsive and has died, leaving no possibility for respiration to take place. So this person cannot and will not ever be able to breathe. But at the same time, they're placed on artificial ventilation, mechanical ventilation. So their heart continues to beat because if you continue to provide the heart with all the things that it needs, including oxygen, then the heart is a self-sufficient pump and will continue to beat. In fact, it can continue to beat outside the body, okay? And so that has created a very important debate today as to whether or not brain death is a halachically appropriate criteria or determination of death. And those who do not embrace brain death kind of point to a mesora of cardiac death. For the last who knows how many centuries, we've been determining death not by a feather anymore, but by the cessation of cardiac movement and resulting circulation. And so that's a critical question. So again, in order to process this, we have to understand what when halachic literature talked about cardiac death and talked about a pulse, what was their understanding of the science and medicine? And it's actually amazing when you realize this. Okay, so you look at the bottom half of the page. Up until the 17th century, and this is what we referred to before, when William Harvey really discovered and taught about the anatomy of circulation, until that time, medicine considered the heart to be an organ of respiration, okay? So now that's based on the father of medicine, Galen, who lived in the 3rd century Rome. His theory held sway until Harvey in the 17th century. And if you look at his writings, he writes very specifically that it was the heart that drew in air, right? And then there was an issue of warm air versus cold air, and then distributed that air to the rest of the body. That was what they understood the heart to be. And I brought two out of about 20 different sources that I've amassed, where you can see clear as day from the Rishonim in the 12th and 13th centuries, Ibn Ezra and Ramban all refer to the heart as being the thing that draws in and expels air, right? And without going into the theory of innate heat, essentially they understood that the body had to be maintained at a certain temperature, and that loss of that temperature or increase in that temperature were both traumatic events that could be lethal. And so there were theories about drawing in air, warming it, distributing it to the rest of the body, etc. And that's how different traumatic events were defined. Like if a shock that would cause someone to either faint or go into cardiac arrest was understood as a sudden opening of the heart that allowed too much hot air to go into the body at one time, raising the temperature of the body and causing either fainting or death. Okay. And that theory prevails to the response of the Chacham Tzvi. The Chacham Tzvi in the early 19th century, the Chacham Tzvi writes, in explaining the function of the heart, you can see in the last source on the page, right? Tam hayot inyan hachayim talui b'neshimas hachotam. The reason why the Talmud placed the termination of life and death in the nose is because derech hachotam yotze ha'avir hacham min halev v'nichnas bo avir kar lekarer halev. Right, and even in the 18th century, right, the theory of circulation hadn't been yet embraced everywhere or even known everywhere, but the Chacham Tzvi explains the function of the heart as an organ of respiration, and so essentially we have to understand that even where there is a Masorah of cardiac death, where if we want to say that for the last number of centuries that death has been defined by cessation of cardiac activity, but that's because the heart was understood as the organ of respiration. It's not a change from what it's consistent with what the Talmud established. The Talmud established that respiration is key. They thought that the heart was the organ of respiration, so that when they thought it was more sophisticated, that when the heart stopped, forget about the nose, when the heart stopped, there certainly was no possibility for respiration, right? But now, in the 20th century, now the 21st century, we know that the heart is not an organ of respiration, but rather an organ of circulation. And we know that really the control center for respiration is not really even the lungs. The lungs do the work, the exchange, but the organ of respiration is the brain and the brainstem. Okay? So we now have a different understanding than they did. Okay, so I'm running out of time, and I thank you for giving me a little bit of extra time because of our technical difficulties. But I just want to pull up one other page. So just bear with me for 1 second. Okay. Somebody just let me know whether you can see this new page here.
You can.
See it fine.
Okay, great. So the question before us is, when I have a set of legal principles that the Talmud establishes, and then I have a scientific reality that the Talmud dealt with, which generates psak halakha, okay? So now, what happens when in modern times, we understand that the reality, the scientific reality, is different from that which is established by the Talmud, okay? So the scientists of today tell us that the absence of respiration from the nose after an accident is not indicative of certain death, but the Talmud said it was. How do we resolve that? Who has the authority in that case? Okay, so just for very quickly, just to take a look at, I picked three sources, one from the period of the Gaonim, one from the period of the Rishonim, one from the period of the Acharonim, just to show you how comprehensive this perspective is. To get a sense of what is actually our Masorah and our tradition. So very quickly, Rav Shri Ragon writes that we need to state that the rabbis in the Talmud are not our physicians. They merely state the conventional wisdom of their age. These statements are not binding. You shouldn't rely on these treatments or use them for anything until medical experts determine that they aren't harmful or dangerous. And then he concludes, this is the tradition that has been passed down. This is what we have been taught by our ancestors and elders. If you went today in the Orthodox world and said that actually Chazal are not an authority on science and medicine, it depends on what circles you would be traveling in, but in a majority of circles in the Orthodox world, you'd be greeted with either you're a heretic, right, or maybe you're a liberal outlier, okay? Rav Shri Ragon says, no, the tradition, our tradition is that the rabbis of the Talmud are the experts in halakha, the legal principles that undergird our legal system. But the experts of science and medicine are the doctors and the scientists. Maimonides essentially says the same thing. What he says is when it comes to, right, remember Maimonides is the one that says there's Torah and there's science. In Torah, the experts are Chazal. But in science, the experts are the scientists. And you know what, says Maimonides, it doesn't matter whether they're Jewish or not. Right? It doesn't matter what perspective they're coming from. When it comes to science, the key thing is, as he writes at the end of the source, every matter whose reason is evident and whose truth is affirmed by incontrovertible evidence, that's the key. We're not relying on the character of the person who stated or taught it, meaning it doesn't matter if the doctor is Jewish, the doctor is frum, or the doctor has the same hashkafa. It doesn't matter. What matters is the scientist and the doctor, is he or she going based on solid scientific evidence that can be demonstrated, the merit of the proof that has been demonstrated and the reasoning that is known. Says Rambam, that's the authoritative force when it comes to science and medicine. And then the Chasam Sofer, right? Chasam Sofer, who is viewed as the father, if you will, of ultra-Orthodoxy and Chadash Asur Min HaTorah. He himself, in writing about the laws of Nida, family purity, which of course involves an understanding of the female reproductive anatomy, he writes, Tosfot wrote all this in accordance with their understanding, Tosfot being a school of many. So did Rashi, explain everything according to their knowledge. And then he writes, after requesting forgiveness from our holy teachers, their words were incorrect. Right? Not their halachic perspective. They understood, and they were the masters of the halacha, but they just didn't know the anatomy because they couldn't, because they didn't have the tools and they didn't have the knowledge to know the anatomy, right? And then says the Chatzam Sofer, how do I know that they were mistaken? Not because I have a different tradition from Chazal, but because I looked at the empirical data, I looked at the anatomy text, I've consulted the expert positions, and it's on that basis, because we're talking about the scientific reality, not the halacha, but the science. On that basis, he determines what the scientific reality is in actuality, and therefore I now take the halacha, the legal principle, I apply them to that scientific reality, and I get the psak, and that psak's not going to be the same as what Rashi and Tosfot wrote, not because the halakha has changed, but because our understanding of the scientific reality has changed. Okay, so now to come back and kind of at least wrap up the part about Talmudic text and modern medicine. The key points are, number one, understanding that psak halakha involves those two components. And then understanding that in our tradition, Chazal are the masters of the halakha. They've worked through it. They've analyzed it. There's been stages of codification. They have the authority on the legal principles. But what they did was they applied their understanding of the scientific reality to those legal principles, and they got their result, their psak halakha. As time goes on, the halakhic principles remain constant, but the scientific reality changes and our understanding of it changes. And therefore, we are not bound to continue to adopt the scientific reality that Chazal had, because their scientific reality was based on the scientific experts of the time. We have an obligation to consult our scientific experts, the texts, the teachers, the scientists, the physicians, take the realities that they have outlined based on empirical data and evidence, apply the time-honored halakhic principles, and then we get a psak. And that psak is going to be different than a psak from 100, 200, 300, 400 years ago, because we've applied the mathematical formula correctly. We've taken the unchanging time-bound principles, applied them to the halakhic reality, to the scientific realities, and we get psak. And that's why the Hatzalah member who comes to the victim does not stop with Hatzalah, it's he. I want to say he or she, but it's not, it's he. When he does not detect respiration of the nose, he doesn't stop there. Why? Because he knows what the halakha is. Until you know vadai mate, that the person is definitely dead, our scientific reality tells us we don't know that the person is dead until we've tried to rescue them, until we've applied advanced life-saving methods in the field, until we've brought them in to emergency medicine and then done everything we possibly can. At some point, we will find out whether or not that person can be saved or not. But we now know that the person's not vadai mate, and therefore our psak is continue to extract the victim from the car, which is a different psak than the Talmud, and different even from the Shulchan Aruch in the 16th century. When it comes to mitzitza, right? So the Talmud said, the mitzitza is critical. What's the halachic principle? The halachic principle is anything which endangers the child, right, cannot be done, and anything which mitigates that danger must be done. Their scientific reality was that evacuating the wound was necessary to prevent danger to the child. Therefore, the psak was not only should mitzitza be done, but it should be done on Shabbat. We take the same principles, apply it to a new reality. Our reality is that evacuation of that squeezing the blood out of the wound site is not necessary. Leaving the wound without doing that procedure does not increase the chance of infection. Not only that, but applying any sort of oral suction and introducing the potential for viral bacterial infection places the child in grave danger. So we, now that we know that, now our PSOC, both about doing direct oral suction and evacuation of the wound, and even doing that at all on Shabbat, our PSOC is going to be different. And the key is understanding the principles, understanding the realities that they were working with and applying those principles to, then going back and saying, taking the same principles, understanding what our scientific reality is, and using that mathematical equation to come up with our PSOC, and having the confidence and the understanding that our PSOC in many ways must be different because the scientific realities in these cases has differed. Now, just to wrap up, when it comes to public health, we come back to this, to the beginning of our class. If you view science as being in conflict with Torah, then you're also going to always decide that Torah is more authoritative, because nothing is greater, nothing outweighs Torah in our worldview. Okay, so if there's a conflict, you're going to give precedence to Torah, and you're always going to view science with suspicion, right? When science comes knocking on your door, you view it as a threat, and you're not going to allow them in until they have shown all their proper credentials and a whole background check to make sure that this is not something which is threatening before you let them in. If you view science as being another path in terms of religious experience, another form of knowledge of our Creator, then there's no reason to view science as suspicious or science as a threat. And the impact on public health is obvious, okay? So when you have vaccinations, for example, right, which science comes knocking at the door and says, right, these vaccinations are critical to public health. If you come from a world that views science as a threat, then you at least have grounds for saying, no, not so fast. And if I have a religious authority, especially if I myself don't have the scientific background to know, all I know is that science and doctors are to be viewed with suspicion, then immediately I have some hesitations, and I can even be swayed to ignore that threat in favor of rabbinic proclamation. When it comes to COVID-19 and coronavirus, I mean, here I think you have a fascinating study, because at the very beginning of the outbreak, you saw, even within the Orthodox community, two very different responses. In the modern Orthodox community, I think, did a fantastic job here of listening to the experts, the scientists, the doctors, without suspicion of ulterior motives, and hearing what the scientific and medical realities were, and taking action early on and courageously, doing things that are unheard of, closing down synagogues, closing down shuls over the holiday of Pesach. I mean, these are unbelievable things. It's the ability to see science as not a threat, but a complementary force in our world that allows for that kind of responsiveness. Whereas in other circles within the Orthodox community, there was, without question, and it's quite well documented, great hesitation at first. Not going to listen to the scientists and the doctors. It's not as bad as the way they're making it out. There's no way we're going to give up things like tefillah b'tzibur, minyan, yeshiva learning. We're not going to do that. And in making those decisions, turn to rabbinic voices without the scientific background, who gave initial psak, if you will, that, you know, we've weathered this type of storm before. We never closed down shuls and schools and such. But of course, in the end, the reality is science is too difficult to ignore. And the reality is that even in communities that view science with suspicion, right, the real reality is they still go to the doctor. The doctor is, and the pharmacologist, the pharmacology is based on science and modern medicine. The treatments that they get in the hospital are based on science and modern medicine, which makes it strange that in some other areas there is this kind of like this love-hate relationship, which is rather inconsistent. And I would say in our modern Orthodox world, we're better about it. But here too, even within the modern Orthodox world, you have people who embrace science as for their livelihood, who embrace it as a subject that their children learn in the school. But then if they go, when they go to the hospital and the doctor explains to them brain death, that their loved one's respiratory center, the brainstem that controls all the reflexes that are basic to life, has died, and by medical science and the law, that means that their loved one is dead. Even within our own community, you have people who push back against that, and we have rabbis in our community. Some of the same rabbis who courageously closed down the shuls and the schools, who for some reason in certain areas have trouble with that full embrace of science. So I think one of the challenges for our community is to realize that science also doesn't speak to Torah. The scientists aren't telling us about whether we should have a relationship with God, that's not a scientific, we're not interested in the scientists and their books of theology. We're very interested in the scientists and the medical experts for their science and their medical expertise, which we then take and integrate it into our worldview and apply this time-honored system that we have. Okay, that was a lot, and there's much more to say, but I'm not going to keep you past 10 o'clock, but I'm happy if anyone has any questions to deal with a couple of those questions, and I'm also happy to continue the conversation with anyone kind of offline or further. Questions, comments?
You can speak up now or forever hold your breath, right?
Ah, very good.
There are some comments in the chat box.
Yeah, I haven't. I can't figure out how to. Okay.
Okay, I'll tell you what they say. How can you do mitzitz on Shabbos? That's the main point.
Yeah. So that's a really good question.
In other words, how is it mutter in the first place?
So I would say it's not. Meaning, if a mohel was willing to ask me my halachic opinion. You know, the issue is that nowadays mohelim operate on their own. They come into your shul, and sometimes it's a struggle. I've had to struggle, even to tell a mohel in my shul, you're not permitted to do mitzitza b'peh because it endangers the child. That's a struggle enough. But there are absolutely contemporary poskim who have ruled that if a bris takes place on Shabbos, there should be no mitzitza, because mitzitza itself is asur on Shabbat. The only justification, according to the Talmud, is because of the sakana. We now know that it poses no sakana, and that is an actual psak, and one that I would absolutely embrace. There are others who justify it by saying that because this was at one point viewed as sakana, it got the authorization to be part of the Brit Milah process. And now, even though we know that it's not necessarily the sakana doesn't exist, because it's been incorporated into the process, you're permitted to do the whole sequence of the process. without even on Shabbat. But it's a little bit of a stretch. I would agree with that wholeheartedly, and I would say it shouldn't be done on Shabbat.